Blog Talk Radio.
Our listeners from the African continent. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in, and from the Middle East, from China, from the East, from China and Pakistan and Turkey. It's interesting. I hope you're finding it interesting. The content useful. To rethink the nature of the common good and our place in it. So welcome. I have to admit that with this show, with a question about the about movement, we all came to this with a challenge that was never spoken to us. That's the bugger of it all. The challenge. The challenge is that we are brought to the door of opportunity. So already we're talking about, and even the very first questions that are asked to us, we're talking about metaphor. We're talking in a language of metaphor. So, which is interesting because, we all have that moment of hesitance. We know that we want to be affirmative. This goes ahead. It's wonderful. It's weighted with such an anticipation that, of course, we say yes to, we respond positively to. But remember that moment in the back of your mind where you're wondering, because this isn't a direct, concrete question. This is a notion of metaphor that you and I are asked to for a response. We stand at the door of an enlightened culture. We don't perhaps know that at the moment, but we'll quickly be absorbed in it. And the question repeats itself. And it reinforces themes that have been with the order from its, you know, from earliest times. And I say that broadly because there's no specifics on this type of notion, I think. To accept that enlightenment is to recognize, in a way, open ourselves to this unpleasantness of growing up and maturing, and that we are saying goodbye to our naivete, not to our imagination, not to that sense of that sense that brings us to the laboratories and to examine and to search for fact and to be creative with our sculpture or our painting or our poetry, to be able to reflect the human condition through metaphor. What does that do for us? Well, that's not so much about the order. It's like saying, here, we're going to give you a remarkable set of pens and to do with as you want. Well, we could give every one of us this remarkable set of pens. And then as an aside, we could say, you know, you're free to, you know, buy whatever paper that you want. Buy your own stationery write. You have the pens. Now, masonry doesn't tell us what to write, or doesn't even tell us. It hints that we ought to write. It would begin very broadly and safely with telling our own story to not to the world but to ourselves, and we can, in doing that, we could. We'll find whether we are giving ourselves only superficial attention because it's a silly, ridiculous, meaningless kind of a process. So who in their right mind does that type of thing these days? Or we could wonder what this might reveal that would make this a worthwhile project to undertake. Of course, it separates. Of course, it stratifies. Because we're working with convention that really does expect us to read in many directions, to pick up our studies in many directions at the same time. There's material within masonry that is the deep dive, where it requires deep thinking, and we slow down for that. In that way, it's not so much the student with his, you know, those wonderfully long reading lists and book lists, where with expectations you begin to write. That means you're not only absorbing this information, but you're expected to digest it and put your own thought to it. And you don't get to linger over that. You're being taught a discipline. Here, do this by this date. So we've got a deadline. All that's doing is teaching us to read and to focus our mind. Of course, you find when you're being put in harness like that, well, how dare them? I'm my own mind. I have my own mind. Some never get over that. You've seen them. They just flunk out all over the place, or they begin to, you know, take if they start to experience overload. You know, I have to admit that my overload didn't happen until I was in graduate school, and then it was like I had to get away. And of course I was fortunate. I had lovely friends around me who were acknowledging that what I was going through was kind of normal. I just couldn't read anymore. It was just this, one of them called it this anti-intellectual pause, where you just have to stop. That you go about your business, you focus on the moment, and And all the other, this absorption of material stops. And how long that goes on? Well, for me, it was, it was a couple of years. And then I, as I think back, if you ask me what stimulated it, you know, it started to gain, I think it was a matter of boundaries I was looking for in the game, the questions, always the questions, always the bloody questions. I pick up something and I found myself after that, I had lovely professors who explained to me that this, you know, this whole process is teaching us to read and to think, to read and to write and to think, some pretty basic. And you rub shoulders with genius, you know, people that are just so energized by the process. And for some who it made it seem like life was easy, and to be told that, you know, you seem to have a gift. I don't remember a very dear woman explaining to me that, you know, we would be competing for marks, you know, as friends do, you know, what did you get? And she would always, she was just an incredible talent. And I was satisfied if I got an A or a B plus or something. That was, you know, intellectually, I was fine. You know, demonstrate, you begin to measure input and output, what you need to do. So my input output was like a second draft. The first draft was a B plus, and the second draft would be an A, and the third draft would be an A plus. And I remember her taking me by the arm one day and saying, you know, this is, you know, we were talking about our abilities, you know, that frank kind of a conversation that one has when they're with close friends and your students. And she was astounded that that's the way she spent so many hours, so much energy perfecting her ideas. And she was astounded that mine would just come. I remember that was the first time I ever spoken with, or anybody had ever spoken to me without an agenda. Well, she might have had one, but I didn't know what the hell it was. And I'm sure that's happened with many of you, that there are things about you that you don't really acknowledge, that just commonplace, not derogatory, not criticism, but things that are the pop psychologists would call them affirmations, and I love affirmations, but things that are inspiring about you and me and the other guy. And as I became older, I found that I discover that in the strangest place I'd be inspired by what I call links. Something would attract my attention, and I would go from one link to another, from the score of an opera to the librettist and to the influences on the period, and then the context of the broader context of the history, you know, that kind of thing. Then I think it becomes inevitable that, it did for me, that I needed to know source. I needed to know the links only as far back as it was practical. I knew always that there would be a metaphysical component that may or may not be practical. And what dictated that was the situation that I was working with in at the time. I was working with other people. How much of a link did they require intellectually? We could sit here and talk about the you know, trying to discover consciousness from this combination of stardust. How did that happen? Well, it was one of the fascinations. Like, I think it's like, for me, making sense out of gravity and time space and the universe expanding, the acceleration of expansion. Those kind of things. Where does that energy, draws an energy from somewhere, going somewhere? So when you begin to think along these, you know, and I don't know if it's a flow of consciousness, maybe that's what it requires. But the returns, you know, I returned to works that they weren't. I didn't go into sort of common, you know, stuff that I found sort of easy. I found that was boring. So, you know, Carlos Castaneda's and, you know, that type of thing. Well, you know, science fiction, you explore that. When somebody is whispering in your ear about the greater mysteries, you of course are drawn to philosophy and history. Of course, the greatest, they find the truths, the most some social comment philosophers are telling us, is one of the greatest challenges of all, the adventure of pursuing truth. And holding yourself to that standard. When we work together and come together in lodges, it's we are bringing our skills, but are we bringing that commitment? No, nobody makes us do that. No. Are we the kind that have been inspired, and are thinking about their social environment and our individual responsibility to one another, to other human beings? Well, those are the questions, I think, for a fellow like me, those would be questions I'd be inclined to ask any applicant, not in terms of judgment, but in terms of curiosity. You've heard from me. I think of masonry as these incredibly complex projects, and within the bigger different layers, you decide in the level of abstraction out there. Of course, if it's you're resting your elbows on the Cabalion or other sources of a philosophical order, then albeit the projects that we have include us as a project, and within that we have subcategories of projects, understanding, deriving meaning, the acquisition of knowledge, and the sense of progression. Perhaps you're a fan of Albert Camus, or you have that ironic, deep sense of humor of Kafka. You know, maybe that's the case. You're into that not because it might raise an eyebrow or two, but because you get it. It comes to you. And you have we can call that an ability. How do you apply that? Well, again, that's another level of inspiration. How do we apply this to the themes and the motifs and the stereotypes that exist within us and around us? Today, we're going to jump into a piece of history that underlines this sense of what we say and what we do. There's enough time that has passed between these incidents until now, so we have a relative period of safety, intellectual safety. We're not likely to be locked into the emotional drama, but we have the safety of time that allows us to re-examine ourselves. And I say that in the sense that there is a quality of the connection of human nature that courses through our history. We are learning about a man, and you and I are that man in a way. That man, you know, brothers by different mothers, men that would recognize one another throughout time, and would recognize an effort and intelligence, whether it's the whether working with the farmer or the guildsman or the brother in a lodge. We're going to hear again a bit more about the emphasis on the distinction of the profane. Why over the years we can start off as an exclusive group that was cautious. We claim it was cautious. We were thoughtful about who we would bring into our little group. Why then over the centuries hasn't it just become diffused? Why isn't it that this has become a 7-Eleven that available as a walk-in on every street corner, but it still maintains some sense of the elusive elite. Where does that's broken down or changed over the centuries? We no longer have the freedom of that class structure that tells us, dictates that is, for all intents and purposes, all you need to know about it, the elite. They are there. We've identified who they are, and there's roles. There's actual roles and rules. They fall into their role. We fall into ours. And if we're looking for and still the vestiges of revelation are with them. Don't blame. Don't find fault with us too quickly that that we embraced science wholeheartedly. Well, science was a bit naughty of us, but we liked that the power of the church was being really disemboweled in a way. Yes, disemboweled. Science came along and had the remarkable minds telling us remarkable things that were irrefutable. And yes, we still had the zealots that wanted to burn people alive for their writings and their ideas, but we still had that, and probably and still do today. We have thousands and thousands of people still living as slaves today, and yet we have declared that we are. We find that immoral, but being able to police this, being able to correct it, to hold people accountable, that's complicated, you have to admit, especially when your prey is men, because men are an elusive prey. They're very clever. And yet the hunting of that is such a challenge. And the hunter will prevail because the hunted tends to always leave evidence of their presence. These are some of the beautiful questions that we can draw into our conversation in Masonry. It's where it becomes spirited is when we have those meetings, and I'm sure you've had them yourself, where there's that flow of consciousness between friends, where ideas bounce one off the other, and the conversation expands, always in our minds, we are able to bring this back to what it does. We can explore these divergent ideas, and explore them for what they might give us that would help our sense of clarity, then their sense of meaning. So the curiosity is always there. When you get to this stage, you've been around for quite a bit. I find naivety, youthful exuberance, interesting, but not really. I find that I need more. What do you possibly talk about? If that's because when that stops, and it inevitably does, it doesn't necessarily curtail our enthusiasm, but it changes the way we speak. And I love that. I love to see the progress of people And you see the truth, as you know, you know the truth by watching behavior. Yeah, as I've often said, that diabolical motto, Aude Vide Tace. You watch and you learn by the behavior what's on the mind, the truth of the individual that you encounter. Yeah. Truths. And who in this day of deception, this day of deception being held to account. Oh, my goodness. Thank you to the to who would we thank? We go back to maybe Alan Turing, and say, you know, for computerization and miniaturization. We go back that far and say, you know, there's been these remarkable contributions and until today, you and I can hold the knowledge of the world in the palm of our hands. And these machines that we all own and our children have long memories. Oh my goodness, and they're so darn accurate. Oh, we can doctor them. Yeah, that's what my generation pretended. You know, we can doctor it, and nobody will ever suspect us. You know, because we're so powerful, who would dare to question our authority? Lots of people, apparently. It was a delusion. You see, we the accountability is around us, and it's hard. Well, there's no more, you know, we'll just let this one wash. I've learned my lesson privately. We'll take steps privately because pride is all important. There is that no more. Now it's right out there. You're exposed. You're there. You're naked in front of the world. And the judgments are, of course, we need some sense of ethics. Tell me, let's talk about values and ethics. Well, there's a collision if you ever saw one coming, isn't it? Deep breath, sit back, fill your glass with whatever it is you love to sip on. And let us here at Masonic Effects entertain. And if we're on target, we'll give something redeeming for your time. Here is something certainly redeeming. Add a bit of an inspiration in his own right, a man that overcame a major disability and strums this instrument. Whew. Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli, 1934. The Hot Club, Paris. We ever notice that masonry is about imperfection? The ideas derived from Aristotle and Pythagoras don't puncture egos at all, as much as teach us that the entrance to various levels of speculative Freemasonry aren't quite wide enough for a person and an ego. One has to go. Rightly so. To extract the opinions that challenge us, old school seems more effective than smartphones, giving our package standardized answers to your questions. We read on a subject enough to gain a sense of the subject that satisfies us, which brings us into our lodge where we blend our personal opinions with others. For many of us, it will be the first time intellect holds the higher rank over status. But we have to discover that by experience. That in itself is affirming for optimists. Everyone needs to be heard. Not everybody is. And we can often realize that the smart idea in the room may be the one that wasn't said out loud or didn't come with the necessary aggression or competitiveness. Nevertheless, how will we know if that's the best idea? We offer up a terse motto to reinforce certain character traits, aude vide tace. For us, the reason, validation, threading truths around and away from the tedium of competitors who need to be right. Nothing to do with that. It's more about accuracy. Instead, this quieter cohort is trying to do it right rather than be right. When we feel supported, it encourages the same in others. Better to bring it up in a tiled lodge regularly because of our transitory nature. Our ideas keep moving. They don't stop. People come and people go. We seem to believe it is preferable to know the good life and live it while we can. So we don't leave anything on the bench. When our time together comes to an end, that's it. Then it will no longer matter who wasted their time trying to best you or me or chase recognition as a salve for insecurity. No, nevertheless, we have puzzles to attend. How are we known if our acts of kindness are kept so private that no one can trace sincere deeds back to us? It's one of the diabolicals. Learn to listen and watch in silence? Diabolically difficult. But do a deed without drawing any attention is an amazing thing. Helping and assisting somebody without lauding it over them, without them feeling in any way beholding, but simply that acknowledgement of truth between two people. Being able to do that and then walk away without the transaction ever being mentioned again. Learn to listen and watch in silence. Yes, you don't need me to say how hard that is, or you're hearing me. This is my winter of discontent. It's because I'm always thinking, do I miss things? Probably do. But do a deed without drawing attention, being the only one in the world who knows that truth. Who do you tell? The man who, without courting applause, who never claims what he has done, will do, can do. But he has that satisfaction, doesn't he? That defines satisfaction and so much more, or so I'm told. You get it. You follow what I'm getting at there. I think you do. With a little, luck, Miles Davis, music of Miles Davis and Britt Woodman and Teddy Charles will have put you in a mood. My, oh my. A mood for a bit of history. There were the question floats around lodges, even to this day, lodges that have not had the conversation. It's the notions about, I think, about the profane. So here we're looking back into the 1800s, late 1800s in Amsterdam. Enough time and distance, do you think, so that we can examine, prickly kinds of subjects without losing our rag, as they say? My author, the wonderful historian Margaret C. Jacob, that writes, in order to comprehend the strength of the prohibition against the profane, we need to examine it within a congenial setting. In some European countries, there were lodges that felt little or no hostility from the civil and religious authorities. Indeed, of all the continental countries from which I am familiar, Sweden offered the most open and congenial environment for Masonic fraternalism. By mid-century, it also governed by a limited monarchy, as it was a parliamentary state. Yet there, too, the profane remained outside the lodges. In lodges composed of the most elite men, sanctioned by the approval of court and clergy, a profane could be a woman or a man, or even of noble rank, who was clearly an outsider. In every sense, however, the distance between the safety and sanctity of the lodge and the world was palpable, and its bridging unacceptable. Just such an elitism characterized the lodges that met in the Royal Palace of Stockholm in the 1750s. We have a privileged view of their proceedings, and at one meeting in particular where a profane made herself privy to its assembly, the Swedish brothers wrote a fascinating detail to the Amsterdam Lodge Le Bien Aimé to describe the event. This is dated Stockholm, 12 August 1757. The 24th June, or the day of St. John Baptiste, the major Masonic feast day, all the members of the three lodges turned out at the church of Lagerlundstan to hear the sermon which was given by Brother Hellman, Director of Theology, and pastor of this church. After vocal and instrumental music, the sermon finished. All the brothers, for the profit of the poor, all the brothers passed by the sacristy. In front of the door, there was a large basin in which, for the profit of the poor, was placed 6,000 dal, intended for the orphanage. After this, we departed from this house, where we had all the children pass in review before us. And then, and this is to show that they were well cared for and thriving. And when we went in 70 carriages to the Palais Royal de Kahlberg, which the king had given over to us for the day, with the promise that he himself would attend our assembly if the state of his health would permit. The shrubs and all the avenues of the garden were guarded by 27 men, and at first we were not allowed to enter without showing tickets or signs, which were all provided. Having all arrived at the garden of this chateau, the three grand masters invited their lodges to dine in the orangery, where we were seated at 3 in the afternoon, and we did not arise until 9 that evening. During this time, the house was guarded by 27 men of the artillery and 15 of the house. In the little garden of the Angerie, there were 6 trumpets of the court and kettle drums, which played at the changing of each course, 7 in all, and discharged a cannon. I must confess that in all my life I have never been at such a grand and agreeable company and such a great diversity of dishes. With regard to the ceremonies, one observed those which are common to the lodge of table. During this time, a lot of people gathered around us, carried away with curiosity. Among others, the wife of the Spanish ambassador asked through one of our members for permission to see a gathering so splendid. Finally, she was permitted. But before she entered, the Grand Masters asked us to cover ourselves by putting on our hats, not to look at the lady in order to signal our disdain at all that is profane. And she entered and exited without anyone having looked at her or having given her attention in any way. But the account did not end there. This breach of a Masonic feast by one of the profane led to consternation and accusations. The brother who observed the entire spectacle shrewdly remarked, "It is remarkable that so many Masons who formerly had been protective of their attire, never showing them to the profane, were on this day so wayward as to display them." And during the same meal, several got up from the table to promenade in the garden, all dressed up as they were. The meal ended, all three lodges promenaded in the garden, led by their grand masters, dressed. In that comfortable, luxurious setting of the Swedish court, many brothers relaxed their prohibition about appearing before the world fully identified by their elaborate costumes, accepted in the highest circles of the state, permitted to preach in a church of the established Lutheran faith, and feted, entertained by the king, who in 1761 became Grand Master. Their dedication to secrecy mellowed. A woman of high rank, almost certainly from the Spanish nobility, was permitted to observe the proceedings. Forays were made out into the world wearing the decorous aprons, gloves, and sashes of the order, but as our witness recounted, the fraternity paid a price for its indiscretion. Ha! Huh. Of course. Digest that. Let that sink in. Hmm. There's a gentility to it. Yeah. Michelle Petrucciani. Rest in peace. Hmm? Brilliant. Brilliant. Today I put the poetry and history out of step. Usually we end with history reading. But today I wanted to end on a different note. Because the poetry, the poet is one that I haven't had on the program, Matthew Arnold. This is the first in all these years. And I'm not quite sure why. I'll tell you a little bit about, he's an interesting guy. He's from the, renowned within the Victorian era as a, but we'll tell you more about that. But the poem that I'm going to share, that we're going to share today, is a sonnet that he wrote to William Shakespeare. Mm. And I always love this when a very famous writer is attributing a piece of the work to somebody with notable fame and of their own. And this certainly does it from many aspects. Among the major Victorian writers, Matthew Arnold is unique that his reputation rests equally on his poetry and his poetry criticism. So this isn't like everything's bad and be grumpy about it. This is like the critique that we're talking about here, that's being mentioned here, is that delicate, nuanced conversation, the impact, the way of words and ideas affect, and that mixture of what was apparent intent and what was the unexpected intent of the work. And he was known for this delicacy, and we still do that. We just turn away from that very bleak, aggressive kind of pettiness. We turn away from that. It's not criticism at all. It's just something else. But this is, so Matthew Arnold lingers in our history, a common history, English language history, as one of those stars that we might want to take into account. Hmm. Yeah. It's kind of a remarkable product of English language, and deny it. I struggle like anybody else. I keep coming back to London, city of London, as the center of the cultural universe. And I know my teeth ache when I say that now. And I'm ignoring. What am I ignoring? Constantinople or Beijing? New York City in the day, or Paris, or yeah, this is a fellow. I'm taking some of this from the site. If you're not a fan, tune in. Britannica, brilliant, brilliant. If you like that kind of accuracy, the fellow is born 24 December 1822. And so our early brethren would have been reading his work and would know, anybody that was literate would know of his work. And that means people that read. Now, we might have been, be saying, well, the trades in those days, generally illiteracy was quite prevalent. And so symbols were a more accurate stage of communication. We haven't lost that sense of the mastery of the work. But you can imagine too, there would be tradesmen that would be encouraged by associating with more literate people to learn to read, and then to be reading, being exposed, listening to the recommendations of your brethren, being exposed to classical literature. And it was still emerging. Who knew? When you see this new material, you see you're living 20 years down the road. This fellow died on the 15th of April, 1888. So in that interval, he wouldn't have walked around necessarily with that renown. Although we did, you know, people in cultured environments can recognize their talent. It's like the recognizing tenors and the mezzos, you know. Oh, of course, we're fortunate, and we have that sense of good fortune. And so was the effect of Matthew Arnold. He was well educated. His father happened to be, or was appointed to the head, was headmaster of a rugby school in 1828. Now, it's not a school about rugby, but, and then he graduated from there and went on to attend Oxford as a scholar at the Beloit College, one of the more, is it safe to say of all the colleges that this is one of the more distinguished. And he won a prize as a student, a Newdigate Prize, with his poem Cromwell. That's a bit chewy for an undergrad, isn't it, wouldn't you say? And he graduated with second-class honors in 1844, which is goes on to say that the degree is only a precursor. It's no way a limit on what a person can do. He's a traveler. He went all through Britain, and several times he was sent by the government to inquire about the state of education in France and Germany and Holland and Switzerland. Like, people wanted to know so they could absorb good ideas and exchange ideas. And these reports on schools were so well written, they were reprinted as books. But anyway, we need to settle today on not only his sense of the critique of poetry, but as a writer himself. Here, he had a reputation, and this is why. This is remarkable. This poem, this sonnet, as a tribute to William Shakespeare, who was already known, you know, 16th century guy, that guy. And here it is, it just in all its glory, all pains the immortal spirit must endure. He had views on culture and education, and he was very, very influential. He became, his day job was the inspector of schools. Okay, that guy. So here I'll stop. Others abide our question, 14 lines, the sonnet. Others abide our question, thou art free. We ask and ask, thou smilest and art still, outtopping knowledge. For the loftiest hill, who to the stars uncrowns his majesty, planting his steadfast footsteps in the sea, making the heaven of heavens his dwelling place, spares but the cloudy border of his base to the foiled searching of mortality. And though, who didst the stars and sunbeams know, self-schooled, self-scanned, self-honored, self-secure, didst tread on earth unguessed at? Better so. All pains the immortal spirit must endure. All weakness which impairs, all griefs which bow, find their sole speech in that victorious brow. What a tribute to William Shakespeare. What a remarkable tribute. The range, all weakness which impairs, all pains the immortal spirit must endure. He writes about it. And the greatness, planting his steadfast footsteps in the sea, making the heaven of heavens his dwelling place. He was that good, that far beyond us all. Source of light, and he did it. You know, you can hear Frank Sinatra, he did it my way. Self-schooled, self-scanned. He was monitoring himself. He was self-aware, self-secure, self-honored. Ha! For the loftiest hills. What do you think? By the time Arnold wrote the poem in the 1840s, It was written just 100 years before I was born. Oops. Shakespeare's reputation as greatest English poet had already been secured. It hadn't always been that way until, and this is a message for the rest of us. One of the greatest minds of the time, Samuel Johnson, undertook to criticize. He wrote a detailed criticism and raised the importance of the poet of Shakespeare to a credible level that it acknowledged. This is acknowledgement when these serious minds want to do an analysis of you. Of course, it's simply addressing that we're not looking at the pettiness and childish sense of perfection. We're looking at, you know, the mind and the work. The greatness of other poets remains open to question and scrutiny, but Shakespeare is free of such discussion. His greatness is unquestionable, unless you're George Bernard Shaw. Well, we've come to the conclusion. That's the show for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. I look forward to being with you again soon. Thanks for tuning in wherever you happen to be. And remember, while you may seem and acknowledge the insignificance of any one of us, that sense of fairness and compassion that we have, we can exercise in our behavior. The world needs it right now. We ought to be the alternative to the vitriol, to that reflexive defensiveness of ideas. We can be the beacons that show that it's the examination of ideas that makes us better people. And we exchange ideas and learn one from the other. I'll see you all in a very short period of time, in a week, and we'll pick this up. The more questions, more learnings, more of the new beginning. You live in the moment, which I hope, and you find contentment within the quiet and humble sphere of your life. Bye for now.